Hey, HG 101 fans, I want you to know that we're crowdfunding a brand new, gorgeously printed hardcover book covering 101 weird, obscure, historically important, and just plain cool Japanese video games. It's going to be called Hardcore Gaming 101 Presents Japanese Video Game Obscurities, but we can only put it out with your pledge. So check out hardcoregaming101.net. The link should be pretty much close to the top of the page. Japanese Video Game Obscurities. If we get to do this, it's going to be our best looking book yet, and it's one of those books that it'll be about stuff you've probably never heard of. In fact, I can almost guarantee you won't have heard of almost all of it. So give a hoot, fund our book, $15 for the PDF, $20 plus shipping for the hardcover. Do it!
Hello and welcome to episode 85 of HardcoreGaming101.net's top 47,858 games of all time podcast, where we objectively, definitively, and scientifically rank the games you nominate. My name is Carl, and I wish my grandfather left me the ultimate giant robot in his will. My panelists today are...
I'm Bobinator.
The Gunholt.
And I'm Maple.
That is fantastic. And on this podcast, we have three rules. Rule one, all rankings are final, official, and scientifically accurate. Rule two, you can nominate one game via a five-star review on iTunes or Stitcher. We've stopped accepting nominations via Twitter for the foreseeable future. And rule number three, you can nominate games that have already been nominated. Just don't nominate games that we've already ranked. You can see the master list for yourself. Check out bit.ly/47kgames. And our next game is Tech Romancer. It was nominated by @ZQAdamsTX. Those letters better be short for something.
I'm pretty sure TX might stand for Texas.
Maybe. I wonder if it could actually be ZQADamsTX, because that could be a third letter there. I don't know. This game, Tecromancer, was developed by Capcom. It was published by Capcom, and it was released on the arcade and later on the Sega Dreamcast. Its earliest release date and territory was September 1998 in Japan. And that was the arcade release. And yeah, the Dreamcast release was, I think, a couple of years later in 2000. And it's a game about giant robots. And by that, I mean almost literally. It is the most giant-y, robot-y, giant robot game that has probably been produced ever outside of maybe Super Robot Wars. Gunhart, I know you're itching to say something about this, so why don't you just take it out?
Basically, this is a 3D fighting game where all of the characters are homages to famous Japanese giant robots and also the superhero Ultraman. It's a little bit like a proto Power Stone in that the arenas are full booming 3D with power-ups you can grab that give you special weapons, each one different depending on the character you choose.
But, that one of the characters actually pilots a robot, like, by standing and, like, you know, like just standing around and punching, right? Like, that's all of the robots are controlled in the various styles and ways that they are controlled in animes, so that's really cool.
Yeah, though sadly you rarely get a cockpit view outside of maybe the brief glimpse of Diana 17's cockpit in the intro. Weirdly, one of the more unusual things I caught was that in the unlockable concept art, you can actually see that the Grand Kaiser's cockpit is taken directly from Mobile Suit Gundam rather than Mazinger Z, like its inspiration.
So that is one of the more, I think, on-the-nose parodies, I guess, in this game. It's almost just exactly Mazin Z.
It's Mazinger Z with Gunbuster's general head shape and its Super Inazuma kick.
I want to say, though, I really wish there were more fighting games and games in general. Like, every character is, like, a character from their own show, I guess. Evil Zone was really good at that.
I thought it was interesting that this game and Evil Zone are basically contemporaries to each other. And they play kind of similar, too. They both share the sort of semi-arena-based setting with a lot of context-sensitive sort of directional movement. Because this game's controls are... I want to say this game's controls are one of the reasons it didn't ultimately set the world on fire. it's a little bit tricky to get into.
Especially on a Dreamcast pad, where a lot of the moves rely on being able to press two of the buttons at the same time, and it's very hard to map buttons in such a way that they're easily adjacent to one another.
And they also, they tried to help you out, because I think the game only uses four buttons, so the two shoulders can be shortcuts, I think, that you can customize.
You have to sacrifice the ability to change items if you want to map both of them to shortcuts, basically.
Using the items is kind of tricky in this, I found. Mostly, and this is kind of something that I think this game has, which I guess is the other... I don't get me wrong, I like this game. I really do. I think it's great. But one of the other issues I had is it kind of feels kind of clunky in a way that some of the robots, it makes sense that they're really clunky. Like, I can accept some of the robots being, like, really brick-like in how they operate. But using those abilities, some of them are kind of tricky. Like, you press the three buttons, which is a pain in the ass to press three buttons on the controller. You got to kind of crab hand it to really get those buttons pressed. But then it triggers in some of the items and stuff. You know, some of these special abilities, they like, you know, they do full giant robot style. They like stop, they stand, they go, I'm using my ability, and then they shoot ability. And by that time, your opponent has blocked or ran around or jumped in the air. You know, they're kind of tricky, and some of them are very difficult to operate with, especially when you have to sort of pause yourself to kind of manipulate the controls.
Yeah, that was my biggest problem. There are so many shortcuts and that you can't really remember them all. And there's not quite enough buttons to set everything on the controller.
One thing that's kind of annoying about the item use is that there is a fit for this that some of them use, but it's inconsistently applied. Some of them, when you use the weapon item, it'll equip it and replace your regular attack. That's fine, but so many, especially the ones with some lead up, will require you to use the item command every time and to fire it.
Yeah, like when I'm just trying to use like an arrow, like to shoot like a single projectile, that's a lot of lead in and it feels kind of difficult to use. But unfortunately, you can't remap the D-pad, which is a shame. I don't think you can, because you can use the analog stick or the D-pad to control your character. And unfortunately, I don't think it gives the option to just slam a bunch of shortcuts on one of those alternatively. That would have helped a lot.
This would be just perfect on any controller that had a select button and four shoulder buttons.
It's really a shame that this game came out in 1998/2000, because that's the exact year when it was going to end up on the Dreamcast. If it was a little bit later, they would have put it on the PlayStation 2 almost definitely. And if it was a little sooner, I could see them maybe having just put it on the PlayStation and not bothering with the Dreamcast.
The arcade version actually does look like a high frame rate upscaled PlayStation game.
Yes, it's not a Naomi board, correct? It's actually a different system, isn't it? But it is a pretty good looking game, especially the Dreamcast version. There's some really nice touches. You know, obviously there's buildings and stuff that explode when you hit them. But when characters get knocked, they leave that really cool dirt trail on the ground. That's so cool.
I like basically that despite the pulled back view, the character animations really still sell that feeling of controlling a giant robot.
There definitely is a slight clunkiness, as I was saying, that does kind of sell that you are in big robots as opposed to smaller robots.
Or just personal robot suit for that matter.
Yeah, and it works pretty cool. And we didn't quite, we mentioned that it is a smorgasbord of characters.
This thing I really need to go into here. The cool thing here is that there's actually a bit of pedigree to the homages here. The original concept and most mechanical designs are by Shoji Kawamori, who some might know as the creator of Macross, or at least the main mechanical designer. He's basically the guy who invented the idea of giant robots transforming. In fact, so much so that he designed the toy Optimus Prime was based on.
Did he design Battle Convoy?
Yep, he designed the Battle Convoy.
And yeah, like, I mean, the design quality is just, it is top. You can really feel the quality there. I believe with Macross, wasn't it, the specific thing about transforming was that it was a perfect transformation. It wasn't parts moving off and recombining.
Right. He was actually, if I recall, he had a degree in aircraft engineering, which explains a lot.
But there are other robots here. It's kind of like, it's all of the robots. You've got something that vaguely looks like an Ava.
Actually, that one's really fun. Pulseon is basically the classic tokusatsu hero Ultraman with his hero form taking a lot of cues from Evangelion.
And there's Wild Goose, who is...
Wise Duck, which is actually meant to resemble the Destroid monster from Macross. The Destroids are basically what all of the original battle mechs were based off of.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you play it, you might think, hey, that looks really Western. It is and it isn't. It's and you got all these diverse styles. You've got a giant robot girl sort of robot.
That one is also really obscure hot take. LOL 80s OVA that basically is an archetype we've only really seen copied in video games. And of course, since Shoji Kawamori is the mecha designer, the Wafaga is basically a Macross variable fighter. It's even called a variable fighter in the game.
And it does variable, right? It has does it have the three modes or the two modes?
Yeah, it has all three modes. Each one has a different super move too. And its weapons, of course, are missiles. Lots of missiles.
Yeah, so this game, since we didn't quite mention, I guess, the fighting elements in this are, I would say, kind of lightweight. You know, it's not really about huge, elaborate, long combos, as far as I can tell.
As far as I can tell, each character seems to have only one real melee combo, and following special moves that create auto combos.
I kind of appreciate that, because I appreciate fighting games where, like, the focus is more on, like, knowing what to do and when, and less about being able to do the move.
Yeah, and this is, again, like, why this does remind me of Evil Zone. To an extent, it reminds me of Power Stone, but it really is closer to something like Evil Zone, or some of the Naruto fighting games. There's this line of fighters where you're always kind of locked onto your opponent, and it's more about deciding, do I block? Do I use a ranged attack? Do I use a closer? Do I dodge? And it's all about kind of, like, faking out and determining what you should do against your opponent, and then knowing what they can do. And it's all fighting game stuff, but it's a little bit lighter weight. And the problem is, it's so difficult to kind of just get the game initially. Like, you know, you really have to bury your face in the manual or on a guide online to sort of go, oh, I see, it plays like that. And this game doesn't have a tutorial, even the Dreamcast version. It doesn't even have a, like, practice mode.
I don't get the lack of a just having a single matches against AI to whoever you want to fight against.
It's really strange, because the game has a bunch of, like, bonus content. It has, like, 3 or 4 VMU games. It's got some other random garbage in there, like, you know, as concept art and stuff hiding in there. And for reasons that make me think maybe it's not a super, like, high-budget port, you can't play as the boss mechs. They're not playable, like, at all. It's weird. The game doesn't have a huge roster, and there's, like, 3 characters that you just cannot play.
And weirdo still, most of the unlockable characters are just palette swaps with different pilots and the dialogue.
So it is kind of, like, lightweight.
Though you can unlock the Bloody Earth from Old Warriors and Cyberbots, which is really cool.
That's the main secret character, isn't it?
It even has Jin Sotome as the pilot.
I do get, like, there was a real passion in this game, and some of it was kind of misdirected, I think, but I don't know, like, if you love giant robots, you should adore this game. And I think what lets this game down to an extent is that because they are so heavily referential characters, the game didn't have, I guess, characters to bill itself on. It can only bill itself as these characters from other games or other animes and stuff are in our game. Isn't this great?
Yeah, that's kind of where that separates it from Virtual On, where all of the virtual worlds kind of have their own identity that makes them characters in and of themselves.
And I, you know, it's a shame, because I think this one is worth trying to get. The story mode is pretty cool. It has multiple paths, right?
I want to dive into that one myself, if you don't mind. The thing I find interesting about story mode is that it's not simply, like, the same story from different characters' perspective. I mean, there is the general overarching concept of this one particular villain showing up to ruin things, and the character or having to wise up to beat them, but the roles everyone plays in the story can differ drastically between worlds. If you play as the Gundam homage Ditsun, it even becomes a straight-up Gundam-style story, and I don't think you even fight the normal final boss on that world.
Yeah, so I really like that, and that feels, again, and, you know, I am one of the biggest Evil Zone fans in on the internet, and that it does a similar thing, and they both do it where they present themselves each, like, they reappropriate the characters into a story for that character that you're playing as. So there is a lot of, like, really cool, like, effort put in. And yeah, it's got a theme song, and it's got that cool little anime opening when you let it go into a track mode.
You can even unlock a full animated opening, which is pretty neat. And another cool thing that's really interesting about the story mode is that there are actual branches to it. Certain fights have special conditions, or if you complete them, you're given choice that determines what the next level will be, and this gets you different endings too. The Wise Duck story is probably one of the most infamous for being amazingly depressing compared to every other character's story, though. Given how everything else is like more homage bordering on pastiche, that one plays it surprisingly straight.
Isn't that Wild Duck also piloted by like five people? It's kind of crazy, like the layout. It's interesting, and I like that. I think this game is pretty great. I don't know. I guess this game really needed kind of like a all the budget sequel, like where they could solidify their ideas.
Yeah, it's like the only weird Capcom fighting game experiment they did that didn't get at least one sequel.
Yeah, except Red Earth.
Oh yeah, I forgot about Red Earth. Said about 100 other people.
And it's great. It's also pretty great multiplayer, I think.
Yeah, it's definitely more fun against another person because those certain tactics the AI almost never uses, like running towards or away from the camera, or generally just using the full 3D axis.
Yeah, I pretty much can't play fighting games since AI anymore. I just try not to do it if I can help it.
Also, that said, the final boss is a total joke. It gets a full revive after you win two rounds with it, and you don't. You don't get its health revive, you don't get the wins reset if you were lost a round against it, and the only thing you get restored at all is your armor gauge. It is a real pain.
I do like that element of this game, though, that again, it tries to capture that robot fighting thing. It is one of the rare fighting games that has a continuous life bar that's split in two, so essentially, you win a round and then your life does not reset. Your opponent's just, you know, starts their next bar. So there is kind of a dramatic comeback element to the game. And way before Soul Calibur, or, and I think maybe marginally before Guilty Gear decided to do it, but maybe not, there is kind of an instant kill special ability that you have only if you're kind of winning and everything's going your way.
If your opponent has lost half their health, you can then perform a final attack.
Unfortunately, it is a little tricky to land in a way that's like, it's incredibly hard to hit with. But, you know, it's an interesting threat to have.
I think the only real other issue I probably have is that each character has only one final attack, so it does get a little bit old if you manage to pull it off time after time and see the same animation play out the same way. Though I do love how they do that whole homage to a 70s anime with the hand-drawn explosions right in front of the screen.
That is really great. It's just like there's a humongous sort of nuclear-style mushroom cloud with smoke pours out everywhere.
And I'll tell you that part. I'm talking about the lead-up. All these hand-drawn explosions that flash in front of the screen for, like, I'd say four more frames, like, in a lower-budget TV series.
Yeah, and then you just see the enemy's, like, defeated, you know, it's like smoking robot just lying there, which is so typical of those shows, because showing that, like, beating them up would be way too expensive. I mean, it is good. This one's very enjoyable, but it's also one that I think you can, when you play it, you can immediately see why it did not succeed, which is, I always think that's nice. A game that's sort of, you know, it's very clear what it is when you play it, which is nice. Does anyone have a placement in mind?
Here's my question. Do we put this above or below Power Stone?
One problem I have with the original Power Stone is just how effective the jump kick is. It kind of just becomes a rush to get those MacGuffins by jump kicking each other, unleashing your attacks, and then repeating the process over again. And I appreciate that Techromancer doesn't really do that, at least not as easily as far as I can tell.
My counterpoint to Techromancer in that regard is Power Stone, you can kind of get what Power Stone is doing in about 10 seconds, and it's kind of fun to play. Once, like, immediately, which is a good element for an arcade game to have. It's not as important for a home game, but I do like the ease of play in Power Stone, and I think that that's something that Techromancer could have taken on board, I think, right from the start. You could have simplified some elements that I don't think would have damaged the playability.
Well, it's often that this one did predate Power Stone a bit.
Did it barely? Because, I mean, I guess Power Stone was 99 then?
Yeah, February 13th, 1999.
Wow, there's only a few months between them.
And that one was on actual Naomi board.
Yes, and you can tell it looks very nice in the arcade.
And I think I'm going to put it below Power Stone, mostly because, as we discussed when we were talking about Power Stone was a really influential game, even if I don't think people realize that nowadays. Like, everybody's ripped off Power Stone. Nobody, sadly, has ripped off Techromancer.
Well, in that case, I think I am going to probably drop it down a little bit to maybe between Guardian Heroes and Splatterhouse.
That sounds fair to me.
I'm definitely failing in this general area, because I think Techromancer, other than its little foibles that it has, is a great experience. So it's worth playing, and this is definitely in the upper realms of our worth playing, sort of thing.
It isn't also in that weird realm where, while it's perfectly playable without it, kind of knowing all of the things it's referencing does increase the enjoyment factor a lot.
Yeah, I think that it also, again, and I wanted to mention this, 1998 especially was probably too early to get those newling anime fans that were going to explode a few years later into buying like thousands of anime DVDs.
I'm not really sure, because Mazinger never really caught on in the US, and Gundam Wing was the one that would have been most popular at the time. So it probably wouldn't have really connected over here that well.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, it was really hard for this one to sell itself. I mean, we've got Bushido Blade there. Yeah, I think that's pretty fair. And I'm willing to put it there because, there's no Golden Lytan in this. And I mean, where is Golden Lytan? Why isn't he here? Why? Where is his boxiness and his shiny golden ass? Like, where is he?
Every fighting game needs like a juggernaut type.
Let's do it. I like Splatterhouse, which isn't Splatterhouse is a referential game, but I do think this one is maybe not more influential, but I do kind of probably maybe it's slightly more fun to play. Splatterhouse is kind of a drudge. So I'm happy above or below Guardian Heroes, to be honest. It's up to you guys.
I think Guardian Heroes might technically be the better title here, so I think I'm satisfied with this position.
All right, we're putting it in at 110 above Splatterhouse and below Guardian Heroes.
Piled on, everybody.
Okay, so our next game up on the list is The Dig. It was nominated by @CarlLatino, developed by LucasArts. It was published by LucasArts. It was released pretty much exclusively, I think, on the PC or personal computer. I believe it was, what was it, actually for like DOS or early Windows? Both. Its earliest release date and territory was November 30th, 1995 in the USA, and probably most everywhere else afterwards. I don't know if it received any language translations anywhere, but it doesn't matter because it's a LucasArts game and we're talking about the English version. And it is about some people who go into space and get lost in space and then they have to dig. I believe that's the plot.
Isn't it basically like, what was that movie, Armageddon?
It starts off more or less like Armageddon. I never really understood how it works. The intro's really great. Let me just say, like, not just the presentation, which is really cool, because it starts off with them detecting an asteroid coming towards the Earth. Then there's a press conference, which is very stylistic, like, very, like, cinematic, like, genuinely cinematic in a way that not many games were doing in 95. Your hero, Boston Lowe, introduces the characters that are going to be in the game. They all establish their characters to an extent. And then you're immediately in space next to the asteroid. Which is kind of confusing, but that's how the intro goes. And then you just start like dicking around in space and trying to work out how to release the pig. And it's kind of procedural in a way that's unexpectedly procedural. You have to actually work out how to do everything. And I feel like just even at the intro, you're kind of fumbling around a bit to work out what you need to do. I don't know if anyone else had that impression from the start, but I really like it. There's a subtle soundtrack playing, like very atmospheric music. You're floating around in space. Everyone's just talking over their little intercoms. You can radio the ship. And then you go off and float onto an asteroid and you have to dig it and plant bombs on it and stuff. And it just feels like a very cold opening to sort of a sci-fi story. It's pretty cool, the intro. I like that.
So I want to say, though, this is a pretty hard sci-fi when you compare it to a lot of other sci-fi adventure games. And I don't think that's something that comes up terribly often in this genre, is it?
A very notable thing about this game is it's from LucasArts, but it could easily be a Sierra game. Like, it just has that. It's not particularly funny, and when it is funny, it almost feels like a last minute rewrite of the script, like reshoots or something, where they're like, no, in this scene, you need to see something wacky, like, whoa, that guy almost ripped my shoe off. I was almost a human pancake or something stupid. And it's like, yeah.
You are almost a Jill sandwich.
Yeah, like it really, like it feels like the most out of place thing sometimes when there's humor in this. You know, I'm not saying that something shouldn't have humor in it. Like, you got to be humorless and boring.
I feel like they wrote the whole story first hand and then like, okay, here's all the other bits that we have to fill in now. So that came all in the last minute. Yeah.
I'll explain this a little bit later because we'll go through the game a little bit. You quickly discover that the asteroid, which that's what I was going to say if I ever tailed off here, it kind of just comes to Earth and then stops. It's really weird how the asteroid is just floating in front of the Earth, even though it's about to hit the Earth or something. It's kind of confusing, and clearly it has to do with some problems they had with the script. But very quickly, it turns out that the asteroid is not exactly entirely an asteroid. You end up on an alien planet, and then I guess the game proper really kicks into gear. That's kind of an intro, and then now you're in the game itself. And as the scientist Brink so eloquently points out, this is no longer a space mission. It is an archaeological dig. And he's voiced by Steve Blum, which is great, because, of course, he should be in this game. He should be in every game. And then it kind of becomes like almost a Myst-type game, as interpreted by someone who only makes LucasArts adventure games. And that's kind of its problem. It's kind of shaky in terms of what you do, because it's kind of a mix of logic puzzles, and then suddenly you have to do something really goofy and nonsensical, and it's like, huh?
And there's a lot of pixel hunting.
Yeah, there's plenty of stuff that you can overlook, because unlike, I guess, a lot of earlier games, this one is absolutely, positively, 100% beautiful. It is so gorgeous. But most of the interactables are seamlessly blended into the environment to the extent that you can easily overlook so many objects in this game that you didn't want to overlook.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of the visuals in this game, and I really like where they were going with this, but Industrial Light and Magic was brought in to do a lot of the 3D CGI for this game, but they tried to do something that they weren't really ready for. I mean, this was released in 1995, so to fit all of the full motion video 3D rendered graphics in the CD, they had to compress it a lot, and the result is that a lot of the scene transitions, a lot of the movement, it becomes a bit too soft. The image gets too soft, and like if you have to like notice details, they all get lost in some of the parts. The hand-drawn pixel parts of the game, those look really crisp, and they clash with everything that was computer generated, because that just gets compressed down and loses all the detail.
Yeah.
Oh, and the animation is absolutely, it just looks too goofy and clashes with everything else.
Yeah, like whenever they cut to the cutscenes, they just,
It feels like Hotel Mario all over again.
It's kind of annoying, because the very start of the game, where they're talking in the meeting or the press conference, it looks pretty good, and they talk pretty naturally. There's some natural motion there. But then Brink falls down a hole, and it looks like Looney Tunes as interpreted by a company running off like $3 in Eastern Europe.
Yeah, but I feel like maybe that is related to how this game has just been in development hell since 1989. Like, they started producing this in 1989. They went through like four different producers until they managed to release it. So there have been several big changes in the script. At one point, there was supposed to be another character completely different and in the middle of the other three characters. So, like, it's not surprising how this feels like something badly put together after all of this development hell.
I want to ask a question about this game's development real quick. Why did they go through all the effort of like making a new engine when they already using Scum for everything?
This is Scum.
Well, yeah, but like in development, they were using something else. I never understood why they spent so much time with that.
One of the concepts for the dig was going to involve exploring multiple cities. You were going to have to, there was like a survival engine. You would have to eat food and drink and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
There was all this like highfalutin ideas that, you know, they all brainstormed. And that includes, you know, LucasArtsian like alumni, like Ron Gilbert was involved, Steven Spielberg. This was like his story concept. So he was kind of dropping in and out throughout several years, I think, just checking up on the game, insisting that they put more violence in it, changing his mind when Jurassic Park got in trouble for having too much violence. And so cutting all the violence out of it, except for the poor dogs, which get brutally murdered on screen horribly for a really out of place scene that I guess didn't get cut because they weren't humans. And they're alien dogs, so I guess I don't care. It's kind of obligatory to mention this because I know that if anyone's like, ooh, The Dig, I didn't know about that, but maybe I'm interested in checking out. The dialogue was originally penned by the person that nobody kind of likes anymore, Orson Scott Card, because he's kind of a tremendous dick. He was actually one of the original, apparently, dialogue writer for this. But in the credits, the one of the main people in the final version from LucasArts, Sean Young, is credited as the dialogue as well. So again, we have no idea. Nobody except the people that worked on this game throughout those years. And I don't think they know for sure how much of anyone's contribution is in this game.
I feel like The Dig is not going to get Ron Gilbert post-mortem so soon.
Yeah, I think he dropped out after the first version, I believe. And then it was handed off to the guy that made Loom, Brian Moriarty. And he took a real crack at it. And he had all these great ideas for puzzles and stuff. And then I think that he took too long and they realized that they'd been working on this game for like 3.5-4 years. And so then Sean Young was sort of like brought in to kind of glue it all together and make sense of it. And that's like, so yeah, The Dig has a very interesting development history. And so you can see how interesting the development history is and how nonsensical some of the elements of it are. I'll say that they tried their best to glue it together in a way that makes sense. And if you know why the seams are there, they become more obvious, but you kind of can get away with it. You kind of don't, you know, it mostly works except on the occasions when something is just kind of like, what is that? Huh? Okay, I guess that's the way that works then. And I really like in the credits, and I'll mention this, I guess, before we talk more about The Dig itself, there is a credits, and this is kind of pertinent because, you know, people are getting in trouble now for not crediting teams and stuff or stuff that happens. There is a credit called the LucasArts Ghosts, and I believe that is credits for everyone that worked on the game, but they have no idea if their contribution's still in the game or whether they actually contributed to the final product. They're just called the LucasArts Ghosts, and there's got to be like 24 names in that list of people that came in, worked on the game, and then they don't know what they did because that version's not there anymore. Cool stuff. And the game was originally going to have multiple paths, potentially, which that doesn't really happen. So when we come up against The Dig, it looks great. It's got some really, I guess the music is great. It's fitting and it's grandiose and it's nice to listen to. The voice acting is good. I like it. I think the three main characters and the two side characters and the one other person thing that you meet, they're all well voiced. I actually really like the three main characters in this, which is Boston Low, the bland faced American astronaut, the Brink, who has a first name, I think, but everyone is Lütger, I think. Is it? Am I just being like?
No, I think that's it.
Okay, because he's German, so he's called Lütger. I mean, that's how it works. I like him, even when he kind of becomes a crazy person and his brain explodes. He's still like interesting, and I kind of like the direction they went with him. And I really like the character of Maggie Robbins, who is a very abrasive person without kind of feeling like, oh, she's angry. That's her character. No, she's abrasive but caring, and it doesn't really take shit from Boston Lowe, who kind of flirts around a bit and is just like, well, we should do this. And she's like, no, we're not doing that. That's stupid. I'm going to go do this. You do your thing. I'm going to go over here. And I like that. I think there's a good interaction between the characters in it. As you get further into the plot, it kind of falls apart a bit because the game kind of falls apart. But I still like where they sort of set it up with the characters. And I really like that at the start of the game, Boston Lowe has these two, like, basically astronaut friends who are like his mechanic and sort of tech and the shuttle pilot, and he has a really strong rapport with them. Like, he jokes around with them. You get like a real warmth between him and these characters, and he doesn't have that with Maggie or with Brink because these characters don't know each other. And so when they're sucked to an alien world, you kind of get like immediately things start to fall apart. And I think that's like really nice to have this kind of like serious, like not everyone likes each other kind of thing in a point and click adventure game in 1995. You know, it does to an extent sort of, usually your character's like, I'm the hero and I'm I'm great and everyone is just kind of an ass, or the hero is dumb and sarcastic. And I like that in this, they're kind of just slightly more dimensional than you would expect. And LucasArts would push that a hell of a lot further with Grim Fandango, but it still works pretty well for this one.
Yeah. I think the other two characters who stay in the shuttle, they work more to solidify Boston's character than they do to solidify their own character. I think those two characters are actually pretty damn forced. And when you said that their voice acting was good, I was like, I don't think so. I think the voice acting for those two characters, it got a little bit too forced.
Those two are not as good because they're clearly just drop-ins in terms of voice work. I was really more referring to especially the three main characters who all just kind of,
yeah,
they're strong, and the other two characters needed to be there. I do genuinely wish that fourth character who was going to be there was in this game. I'm sure they cut him out with good reason, but I really want like a fourth character in this dynamic.
For the record, like the fourth character was supposed to be this eccentric billionaire that would buy his way into the mission because he really wanted to be in an alien asteroid. And so he wasn't part of the mission or part of like NASA or anything. He was just like a billionaire who bought his way in, and he would be killed off like in the middle of the story.
He was gonna horribly die in like an acid bath.
Yeah.
Like, okay, so one of the central parts about this game is that there are life resurrecting crystals. I don't know if we should spoiler warning that, but it's kind of the central plot of the whole game.
I don't think anyone's gonna care about spoilers too much.
They had their chance to play the game.
Like, you're here to listen about the game.
It's 23 years old.
Yeah, we assume that you already played this old game.
And the idea was he would melt in an acid bath or something. He would not be able to be resurrected. Whereas Brink dies early on and then gets resurrected. And that his whole plot is basically he becomes a crystal junkie and steadily goes insane. And that's an interesting, again, like a lot of the things in this game are like,
kids, don't do drugs.
Yeah. I mean, don't do whatever green crystals, like meth. Don't do meth. That's always that's good life advice, actually. Don't do meth. You think you're great. And then suddenly you get your hand chapped in a, you know, in a rock, and then a guy rips it off with an alien jawbone. Just, you don't want to do that. It's just not worth it. You know, it doesn't matter how good it is. But yeah, so because like, I think they changed the plot. I think originally the asteroid was just going to show up and everyone was going to be really confused. Because in this case, as I said, like there's an asteroid and then they have to go blow it up. But it's like, you're right in front of the Earth. They mention that they can see the Earth and the asteroid is just floating. See, it's just kind of like these weird little inconsistencies.
I don't think that's mentioned anywhere that it stopped, because I don't think it is. It's just like the Earth is also going super fast through space. It's just that since you're already in the same orbit as the asteroid, to you it's stopped.
Yeah, no, I know, it's just kind of weird, because I know that Boston says to Robbins, you know, like, hey, you know, what's it feel like being in space? And she's like, yeah, I know, that's the Earth, like you're a jackass. Which is what I love about this game, is that you have basically, Boston has a say something smart button, and because the other characters are basically smarter than him, they both basically just trash him when he tries to use the smart button, and I really appreciate that.
Yeah, he's treated basically like your dummy American hero, like a G.I. Joe or something, when everybody else is like, Robbins is a journalist, but they play her like she has 10 PhDs and a Pulitzer, and like
she learns like an alien language and translates it like out of nothing.
Yeah, I feel like the dig is just a really, really unfortunate accident, because this was supposed to be one of Steven Spielberg's amazing stories, and it just didn't happen as a movie or anything like that. So he pushed the script onto LucasArts, said like, okay, maybe you can make a game out of this, and then they like, it became development hell for years and years and years, and then it didn't turn into anything. And they were like, we gotta release a game. So they just bodged anything that they had together to release something. So I feel like the dig was supposed to be a movie. They got like interactive elements shoehorned into it.
It's actually really funny to think about, because when you mentioned that, yeah, originally it was going to be a TV episode, and it was like, we can't film this on a TV budget. And it is amusing to me to think that there was a time, even then, when Spielberg would be like, if Spielberg went with the script and says, I want to make this movie, if he did that today, people would just be like, okay, take your few $100 million and get out of my office kind of deal. Like, he had to like no one would give him the money to make this, so he went to LucasArts and just gave them the idea, and then they brought on famous science fiction writer at the time to help with the dialogue and to flesh it out. And then a bunch of LucasArts creatives got involved. It's crazy. This game kind of, I guess maybe it's too many cooks kind of issue here, where maybe that kind of damned it to an extent.
So I don't know if it's time to rank yet, but I want to put up a question. Do you think this is the worst LucasArts game?
Like, I know that our friend Tenger, who is not here in this recording, but I'm going to mention something that he did want to mention. I think he thinks this is the second worst one after Zach McCracken.
Yeah, I definitely like this way better than Zach McCracken.
Okay, I can agree with that.
So I guess my thing is, I love how daring this game is. I love that it's not a comedy, and that the comedy that is in there, as we said, kind of feels like it was injected in to make it LucasArtsian. Much like the ending, when we get to discussing it, maybe just before we rank it, kind of feels like, oh, we got to make this a happier ending. It's got to be happy because LucasArtsian. You know, like, when you don't have those elements, when you see the game for what it is, what they were maybe trying to do with it in terms of it being kind of more hard sci-fi, or at least like science fiction in like a very, like, it's actually science fiction, it's not a comedy, it's serious. You can feel where they were going with that, and like, you're like, wow, this is really interesting. And I can't think of many point and click games that went in that direction. There is a mountain of Myst clones and Myst likes that are all po-faced serious games about exploring like temples, or exploring like buildings or closed things, or stuff where there's for some reason no people, and they're all very serious and it's all serious time. But in terms of a character driven piece that is a point-and-click adventure game that's played almost entirely seriously, and it's science fiction, it pretty much stands alone. And that's one of the reasons that, like push come to shove, almost all the LucasArts games are kind of better, in that they kind of got, even if their puzzles are kind of nonsense garbage, they're at least funny nonsense garbage. And, you know, they've got, they're cram-packed full of humor and funny situations and stuff. And this game kind of goes in a completely different direction, to the extent that they're almost incomparable. And that's tricky when it comes to saying if it's better or worse. You know, is it important? It's probably not as important. It sold over 300,000 copies, though, which apparently was a huge amount of copies in 95, by the way. But yeah, it's tricky, you know, very, very tricky with this one. I would actually say that it would probably be in the top three or four LucasArts games that I would recommend that you play. You know, if you needed an abridged Cliff Notes of LucasArts, it would probably be in that top four.
Yeah, I think so too. Like, I feel like it's very unfortunate how the dig turned out. Like, I guess I'm just repeating myself, but it should have been way better than it ended up being, because it is an amazing story, or at least it started as a great story. I still think the story that ended up as the final product is good. They just couldn't flesh it out as they wanted. As you mentioned, like, Brink dying in the first 20 minutes of the game, in the first few screens of the game, because there's a whole another underground.
I mean, I think you can instantly kill him. I think if you just grab the shovel and dig, he'll die in like the first couple of minutes.
Right. Okay. Yeah. You can do that before exploring the other parts.
Yeah. It's crazy.
I still like it, even though it's like a rush job and it kind of falls apart in a lot of ways. I still think the story is good. The visuals, even though they have their bad moments with compression, with the animated characters that don't quite fit with the rest of the style of the game, I just feel it's very jarring how the animated characters contrast to like their pixel renderings when you're actually like playing the game and moving the characters around. They look great, but then you get to the animated ones for the cutscenes and it just looks like a CDI game. But the writing is still good. I think the writing is what holds the dig together. I really like sci-fi, so I really like the story.
So, I mean, we're going to talk about the story. So let's, before we get to ranking, let's talk about the ending a little bit. The ending is really, really awful, and I guess if you, for some reason, don't want to hear spoilers, I don't know, skip ahead a few minutes. Hopefully we won't be talking about it at that point. But we have to talk about it because the ending kind of trashes a lot of the game, and it's hard to avoid mentioning it a little bit.
Yeah, the rush job really shows at the end.
Okay, so basically what? Like, the entire game is leading up to Boston finding out what happened to the aliens, which I think is a really satisfying enough sort of string of, like, clues and stuff, and finally finding out mostly what happened. And then he just kind of goes into electronic super sixth space, then somehow using his powers of being a boring American astronaut, he saves the day for reasons that are very poorly ill-defined, and then all the dead characters come back to life, even though we were explicitly told that it was a really bad idea to bring characters back to life, and immortality is extremely dangerous, don't go after it. And then, for some reason, the alien can now navigate sixth space perfectly, even though before he was trapped in there for all of time. And then there's something about humans are not all nice and let's live together in peace and harmony. And Brink looks like an old man. And then in the last cutscene, he looks perfectly fine. And it's very confusing. And then the game just ends. Like, it just literally ends like, the dig, the end. Like, what?
Yeah. And before you say this game has no pets, there are alternate endings. So
doesn't that change just like one or two lines?
Exactly one or two lines. Yes. Okay. So at the end, like more or less like before the end, there's an exchange that I think mimics the potion seller video. Basically the alien telling Robbins and Bossum that they shouldn't open the eye, that it's gotta be bad. Don't do it. You can't handle it. No, we can't handle it. We're gonna do it. No, you can't handle it. You're not brave enough.
Can't touch the eye.
And then in the process of reactivating the eye, which would make Boston be able to enter the sixth dimension, Robbins falls to her death. And she made Boston promise that he would not use a life crystal to revive her because it made Brink go insane.
Incidentally, in a little bit of a bluff, that scene is really great because Boston thinks she's going to say something like really heartfelt. And she doesn't. She says like, Boston, it's really important that you understand. It's like, no, I know what you're going to say. She's like, no, you don't. You're like, she still gets in. Like, you're a freaking idiot. Just, I'm going to tell you, don't revive me with the crystals, asshole. He's like, oh, right.
And then you can continue on the game without reviving her, or you can be a big dummy and revive her with a life crystal. And she just goes and kills herself again by jumping off a cliff.
Yeah, she gives you like a very shocked face. I like that moment because it's a very interesting choice to let you do that, to put that in the game where you can, like, it's really, I think it's a very fringe sort of horror thing.
Yeah, I feel like it was almost not supposed to be there. I think like they wrote it so Boston would be the only one to come back alive from it. And then some playtester realized they still had life crystals in their inventory and tried to use it on her and went to the developers and said, hey, why can't I just do this and bring her back? So they shoehorned it into the story. And it changes after you rescue all the aliens. One of the aliens brings back Brink, who is now 80, because I don't know, age makes if you're just be old, you're not insane because of the crystals anymore. And Robbins is in either endings, she's brought back just as soon as she died. And if you revived her, she goes and slaps you in the face. If you didn't, she hugs you, and it's a happy ending for all of us.
Thanks, the dig. Yeah, so that ending is the one of the closest equivalents I've ever seen in a game to basically, if you were playing the game in front of me and you were about to get the ending, I would smash the power button on your computer and just say, and then Boston Low got lost in the eye forever, the end.
Yeah, the ending is, it just feels so rushed, like, because you entered the sixth dimension, the aliens saw where you came in from and said, oh, that's where we have to exit, and now we're saved because we found our way back, and it makes zero sense.
It undermines everything, and we can't make this clear how unsatisfying it is for a game that was mostly satisfying, except some of the puzzles were tricky, like having to stick a bomb in a turtle, even though the game explicitly says that everything has to be perfect for the turtle to be resurrected. You put a bomb in it anyway and it works. What is up with that? Okay, we're gonna rank this, by the way. We're doing it now. I guess the question that I have, and Bob, you can weigh in on this one as well, because we're gonna start with the Dig versus Riven, the sequel to Myst.
I'll be honest, I'm just really not a big fan of games like Myst. I might be a little bit biased, so my immediate opinion is to put the Dig above Riven, but you're free to disagree.
It's definitely above Nightshade.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what I like with the Dig is how hard it tries and it doesn't get there, but mostly the ending lets you down. I think the ending to Riven's actually pretty good, right? Which is a shame. I can't put the Dig in, honestly, super high. I could praise a lot of elements, individual pieces of the game, but the actual game itself, it's hard to put it high because the end result just lets you down in a way that's like, it's extremely disappointing. It's just like, oh, I really wish that you were just way better.
You want, it ends, but you wanting wanting more. Like, it does some things really well, and then as soon as you're going to the climax of the story, it just...
El Viento at 209 has that kind of slightly awkward, like, feeling of, like, not quite being all together. I'm just trying to think of, like, the highest point that the dig could plausibly be placed at. Because, like, I guess I like so many individual elements about this game. What about around Lethal Enforcers?
I'd put it below LSD for the PS1.
Okay, we're jumping up a little bit.
I don't mean like necessarily just below LSD. I just mean like I think LSD ranks higher.
Okay, no, I think that's fair. I think LSD is more successful without messing up a bunch of stuff. I would put it below Ninja Gaiden, and this is a shout out to Stenga, who again couldn't be here.
I'd put it above Night Trap.
I really like Night Trap. The reason Night Trap is at 186 is entirely me.
Why am I not surprised?
It should be shocking to no one that I'm like, let's put Night Trap higher. But Night Trap is more successful at what it does, you know? It's like...
Is it?
Yeah, well, maybe. No, I think it is. I think that Night Trap's ending is satisfying. You trap the vampires, and then you win, and then you all go home in the scat van.
Yeah, okay. On the dig, you don't even see them going back to Earth.
No, you don't even know if they go back to Earth. They just say they're making a ship. They didn't...
No, the ship leaves.
And then the Star Wars end music plays. Okay, look, I mean, Bob, you're still alive in here. What do you think compared to Night Trap? What do you think?
I do feel like we placed Night Trap maybe a bit too high, so I guess this is... I guess this is my way of trying to fix that mistake.
There are no mistakes in Night Trap!
There are no mistakes in science.
You're not a scientist! So it's going to go at 186 below Raid on Bungling Bay, which is it Bungling Bay? Because Bungling accurately describes the dig, so I'm quite happy to put it below that, above Night Trap, which has now moved to 187. Wingity, wingity, wang! Yeah, that is the sound of a guitar. You can trust me because I know how to play music because I played Guitaru Man, and so did everyone else. And you can catch our Patreon exclusive ranking of Guitaru Man if you supported HG101 on Patreon. And you can support us. I think the minimum is like $2 a month, and you will get access to so much crap. It's unbelievable. And it's a great game, that one. We have absolutely so many things to say about it. I can promise you that we've already recorded it. It was fantastic. Check out our Patreon, HG101's Patreon. You know, we'll see you there. That's all for this episode of Hardcore Gaming 101 Top Games Podcast. Special thanks goes out to at Kyle Latino and at ZQAdamsTX on Twitter for nominating those games. And thanks to those of you we didn't get to yet, we will be getting to you soon. Thanks as well to my lovely co-hosts and co-patriots and booking agent Jeff Frood, our theme song composer Muteki, our sound editor The Gunheart, and our technical assistant, video editor, and scriptwriter Bobinator, and of course the support and feedback of listeners like you. You can support this podcast by making a small monthly donation at patreon.com/HG101, by subscribing to the HG101 YouTube channel, and by following at GC9X and at HG_101 on Twitter. You can also hang out with us on our Discord at bit.ly/HGDiscord. But most importantly, help us claw our way into the podcasting firmament by getting on iTunes, subscribing to HG101, and giving us a 5-star review. Do it, or we'll have to reassemble Xerxes' skeleton, stick a bomb at him, and then cover him in green goop so we can get him podcasting again. Until next week, keep keeping it real.